Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Dismantling Injustice. This week we're joined by Jocelyn Simonson. Jocelyn Simonson is a professor at Brooklyn Law School, a former public defender, and the author of Radical Acts of Justice: How Ordinary People Are Dismantling Mass Incarceration, a book that examines grassroots interventions in the criminal legal system. We have a robust conversation about bail funds, participatory defense, court watching, and how we can begin to hold prosecutors accountable for their role in fueling incarceration. So stay tuned. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, of course, of course. You know, we're super excited to have you. You just released a book, Radical Acts of Justice: How Ordinary People Are Dismantling Mass Incarceration. And so I guess to start, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what motivated you to write this book?
Sure. Yes, I'd be happy to. Yeah, the book just came out a week ago. And so I'm having a lot of fun right now sort of talking about it and also thinking about this question, like, why did I write this thing in the first place? So I'm a law professor at Brooklyn Law School now. I was previously a public defender in the Bronx for 5 years. But I spent a lot of time as a law professor thinking about criminal prosecutions and criminal courts, but especially noticing and being in rooms and in community with groups who are fighting back against the criminal system in different ways. So as much as I think about the structures of our laws and judges and lawyers, a lot of my attention and inspiration from my time as a public defender up through what I do now, which is teach and write and think about the criminal law, what I'm inspired by is when they're called ordinary people in the subtitle, but we can just say people, including lawyers sometimes, people get together to help each other in the face of criminalization. And when they do that collectively, actually do something that's really powerful beyond just taking care of individuals and has something bigger to say about what mass incarceration is, how it might be a problem, and how we might think about justice and safety in other ways. So I came to write it because I'm inspired by it and because I'm in it.
That's so awesome. And in the book, you do a deep dive into some of the ways that some of these, you know, quote unquote, ordinary people are like people that aren't necessarily activists, that they're just, you know, they just kind of, they care about what's happening in the world. But you do a deep dive into some of the ways that they're making radical change in the criminal legal system and beyond. Can you give us just like a high level overview of the strategies that you outlined? And why did you choose these particular strategies to focus on?
Sure. Yeah. So I focus on 4 different strategies in the book. And the first 3 of them are ones that involve people organizing collectively in criminal court. So the first one, which you will be very familiar with, are community bail funds. The second, also something you're familiar with, is court watching. And the third is participatory defense. These first 3, I came to write about because I'm involved with them and I've been thinking and writing about them for about a decade now, which I came to do because, again, as I sat in these courtrooms as a public defender, the place where I was seeing a different way of thinking about things and a different way of acting in the face of mass criminalization was in these groups. So broadly, community bail funds, again, I think listeners will have a general idea of what this means, but it's people getting together collectively to pay bail for strangers. And by that, again, I mean people, but people who aren't family, people who they don't necessarily know, out of a broader view that incarceration, especially pretrial incarceration, is unjust, and doing it over and over, usually in a revolving bail fund, in a way that actually lives out a different understanding of community safety in face of a court system that says that community safety is served by incarceration. Then there's court watching, which is groups of people getting together to sit in their local criminal courtrooms. And instead of watching famous trials, right, we do have some court watching happening in the New York Times, but instead of watching trials or infamous or famous trials, just watching everyday adjudication, everyday people being brought in front of judges for bail hearings for not paying fines, prosecutions, arraignments, things like that, even just a lot of adjournments. And by watching that over time, reporting to the public on what they see, holding public officials accountable, educating the public about what goes on, and ultimately, collectively, doing thinking and reimagining of what we could be doing instead of criminal court is often where it ends up. Participatory defense often flows from these first two strategies, which is when people get together and they collectively intervene in individual cases or support each other while a criminal case is pending. So to take one example, Silicon Valley Debug has pioneered this form of participatory defense hubs where, again, a group of people over time in multiple cases meets together to do things like investigations, making videos to explain to a judge somebody's humanity, and then over time comes to develop a set of practices that can really shift and cause some disorientation in criminal court in a way that can be productive, or collective defense campaigns, for example, on behalf of criminalized survivors from groups like Survived and Punish, connecting individual cases to broader ideas about justice and injustice. And then the fourth strategy of collective organizing that I write about is actually not one that I planned to write about when I started writing the book. But as I was following these groups who were doing this organizing within criminal court in criminal cases, here came 2020, uprisings around the country where people were hearing the slogan defund the police and whether they agreed with it or not, starting to ask bigger questions about how the state spends its money. Like, wait, how much should we spend on policing? Is that what we want to be doing? And in the face of these uprisings, and also some people sitting at home, right, thinking about I'm in lockdown, what's my state doing right now? Mm-hmm. A lot of these same groups started to join into or just become more active in broader coalitions of people who are thinking about budgets and creating people's budgets or other forms of large scale thinking, sometimes involving thousands of people who together would think, if I were in charge of my city or state's money, how would I allocate this money? And coming out of that, just like with these interventions in criminal court, these interventions in city council and state legislatures are not just like, it's not just that they materially help shift budgets, which they sometimes do, but it actually leads to this collective imagining of what justice and safety could be and what the state could be doing to promote justice and safety that seemed inspiring and important, both because people were doing it, and because it was reaching outside of the criminal system to look for justice.
That's amazing. And, you know, I think for us at Envision Freedom Fund, one of the reasons that we changed our name and used the word Envision specifically was because we wanted to provide a space to capture this like fourth category of people that are really not just fighting the system, but also trying to reimagine how the system could look. Through legislative fights, through budget fights, but also through just coming together as communities outside of the activist space. So that's absolutely amazing. So you talk a lot in the book about this idea of quote unquote, the people, which I have to tell you, I like when I was a public defender, I would cringe like every single time I heard a prosecutor say, so-and-so for the people. And I'm like, what people? This word, it's been taken by prosecutors and the criminal legal system, and it's used to dehumanize those that are accused of criminal offenses and to, in many ways, to legitimize their isolation. I guess my question is, how would our systems be different if folks accused of crime were treated as part of, quote-unquote, the people that prosecutors claim to represent? And how are the folks you highlighted taking taking this power back, taking back the power of the people?
Yeah, so to take your original question, I don't think our current system is compatible with an understanding of the people that literally takes every human being in that courtroom as a person, as the people. In the first place, the people being accused of crimes are just not considered people. It's literally the people of the state of New York versus Jocelyn Simonson, right? Mm-hmm. They are on the other side of the V. They are not the people of the state of New York or Illinois or whatever state you're in. It's just on its face incompatible with that. And so what happens is that when a group gets together, let's just take court watching, right? A group of people sit in the courtroom. Often the name people is somehow in their t-shirt, right? They are saying, we're the people, and it's plural people, right? We're not a person, we're a collective of people. And we're sitting here in support of the person being accused, even though we don't know them, because we are, and we're supporting them in the sense that we are watching what's happening to them. We are watching what the state is doing in the name of the people. And as we're doing this watching, guess what? We're the people too. So Courtwatch NYC, for example, one of their first reports was called Not in Our Name, right? So it was this idea, we were sitting here watching what's happening. And it's not just that you are prosecuting people, it's that you are prosecuting people in our name. You're saying it's the people of the state of New York. And there's something incredibly frustrating about the prosecution calling itself the people, and incredibly powerful about collectives of ordinary people. And by that, I just mean they're not elected prosecutors. Some of them aren't lawyers. They can be extraordinary in lots of ways, but they're getting together and they're saying, you cannot stand there and legitimately say that the people of the state of New York are doing that. Some people might agree with you. Some people might be doing that, but don't do that in my name. Don't say that you're doing that to keep me safe, because I don't feel safe when people are put in cages. Don't stand there and say that you're doing justice for me, because that doesn't feel like justice for me. And so to reclaim that idea of the people, let's say there's no one group of 10 people who are the people, and there's certainly no one individual who are the people. But sometimes it's kind of like a, how dare you say that the people of the state of New York are putting this person in a cage, because I'm not okay with that in my name. And part of the reason we know it's so powerful is that prosecutors hate it. Judges hate it. They do not like it when it's called out. They are still standing there calling themselves the people. You can even think about someone like Larry Krasner, you know, a so-called progressive prosecutor, and somebody who does indeed try to put fewer people in jail and prison than many prosecutors do, right? What does he call his book about himself? For the people, right? It's still this idea that I am doing this for the people, instead of acknowledging that perhaps when people are asking to be represented fully in a democratic system, which goes back to your initial question, what would it look like if the people who are being accused of crimes were thought of as part of the demos, as part of the polity? Well, I don't think it would even look like Larry Krasner. I think we would have to conceive of a different sort of justice and a different set of laws and institutions.
Absolutely. I think that we've examined policing very heavily, but we haven't done that with prosecution.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, like the role of the prosecutor is equally as important and detrimental in the criminal legal system. And I just don't know that it's been scrutinized in the same way or reimagined in the same way as of yet.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's not, you know, prosecutors are becoming part of political fights, I think, in ways they haven't before. You could think of in San Francisco, the election of Chase Boudin and then the recall. It's not that we don't have public debates about prosecutors, but we have them in a pretty limited scope of like, how many people are you going to prosecute and for what? Not the way that we're talking about, should we have the police, right? Should the police even be involved in traffic enforcement? Should we have police in schools? We're not asking those questions about prosecutors. Like, should prosecutors be involved in schooling? Should prosecutors be involved in traffic offenses? We should be asking those basic questions. And groups like Court Watchers are asking those questions. They're starting to get that into the sort of public sphere of conversation.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after these messages.
Charm Bar and Restaurant is a Caribbean and American fusion restaurant located in the Park Slope area of Brooklyn, New York. Their cuisine embraces influence and inspiration from Haiti, Jamaica, Trinidad, and many other Caribbean islands. Their menu also highlights several vegan options and signature cocktails curated using the finest and freshest ingredients. This past year, Charm has been featured by Forbes, Ebony, Chase Sapphire, and Black Restaurant Week. And they sponsored Envision Freedom's office warming with a delicious selection from their menu. Dine with them at 448 Dean Street in Brooklyn, adjacent to the Barclays Center, and follow them on Instagram at CharmBarBK.
So the interventions that you highlight in the book seem to work within the system, using what many call the quote-unquote the master's tools to dismantle the system itself. What's so powerful about this insider approach? And could you point to any weaknesses?
Sure. Yes, I would love to do both, because you're right. It's powerful and it's also imperfect. Let's take bail. The Envision Freedom Fund is posting immigration bond. A lot of community bail funds are posting bail. When a group comes in and there's an existing statute that says somebody can be free if this amount of bail or bond is posted, and that is in furtherance of community safety, right? The reason it's being set. So when a group of strangers comes in and says, okay, that's your bail law. Well, I'm now going to pay the bail to free somebody. But they do that. So literally they're obeying the statute and they're giving money to the system that will come back to them when the person comes back to court. So they're obeying the laws. They're using the procedure, right? It's not, they're not, picking the lock on the jail. They're using the rules of the system. But they're actually doing something incredibly subversive, which is they're taking what used to be an idea where someone's individually paying their money, and they're coming in as a collective and saying, no, we're the community, and we're going to pay this money, and we're going to live out a different idea of safety and justice that flies in the face of what the system says that safety and justice is. It's incredibly powerful. It's incredibly subversive. And the fact that the system bristles and gets angry and tries to shut down bail funds when they do something about that shows its power, because it's not just that the system doesn't like people being free. The system doesn't like it when a group comes in and shows us that there are other ways to think about safety and freedom. So that's just one example of like a tool when used against the system can be subversive, but it absolutely has limits in a couple of senses. First of all, there is no way that this is the only way to make change, nor should it be the only way to make change. Riots, disruption, picking locks on jails, right? Those are powerful ways to make change. Civil disobedience. There are a lot of ways of disobeying the laws that also can have collective organizing movement power. There's also, bigger ideas of democracy, right? Voting, enfranchisement. There are lots of ways to make change and make democratic change. And so one of the limits would be saying that using the tools of the system is the only way to do it, that we always have to follow the rules. And another risk is in legitimizing the system that you're working within. And as you know, this is something that the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund, which is now your Envision Freedom Fund, faced at a point where you made the collective decision to stop posting bail in criminal court in New York State out of a worry that you were becoming an arm of the system, that you were legitimizing the system, which had done this specific carve out of particular misdemeanor cases that bail funds could suddenly post bail for. And I don't want to put words in your mouth too much, but there's a powerful statement in which you say, wait a minute, the state can't make us part of their apparatus, right? Community bail funds are most powerful when they're doing it not in partnership with the state, but in direct opposition to the state's vision of safety and justice.
Yeah, that was one of the key reasons that we stopped paying bail was we were, during the legislative negotiations, legislators said, well, we always have the bail fund, so we can, it's okay if we don't, give these things. And we realized that we were becoming a crutch on the system.
Absolutely. And so, and there are other ways that you could legitimize the system. It's not unique to this sort of tactic, right? Any organizing tactic can be a legitimizing force, or a revolutionary force, or just, or simply a disruptive force to the status quo. And so what I don't mean to suggest in the book is that these tactics are the answer. As much as reading stories and listening to these tactics, I hope will make everyone look around their own communities and see, not can I necessarily start a new bail fund or something, but what are people doing right now collectively to work towards safety and freedom? How are people taking care of each other? What's the tactic that people are doing now? Let's follow that. Let's organize it. Let's organize. Let's talk to other people and perhaps consider the tactics in these books, not because they're the answer, but because they are happening right now, right? The book basically tells a story of the last decade of certain forms of organizing, and those forms have not gone away.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after these messages.
Over the last 8 years, Envision Freedom Fund has paid more than $14 million to free close to 6,000 individuals from pretrial jailing or immigration detention. Thank you to all of our donors who help us to pay the too high price for freedom. We know that paying bond will never be enough on its own to end the humanitarian crisis of incarceration and the surveillance of Black, Brown, and immigrant communities. That's why we also fight to dismantle the systems that harm our communities in the first place. If this sounds like the transformative change that you believe in, you can join us. Visit our website, envisionfreedom.org, or click the link right on our Spotify profile to donate to Envision Freedom Fund. Because freedom for all people will take all of us.
Earlier in our conversation, you talked about court watching and you talked about participatory defense, and you got into like how they have related to one another and how they uplift and they complement one another as strategies. And so I want to dig a little bit more into the court watch part of the conversation. And you wrote about Court Watch NYC's philosophical evolution from fighting for reforms to fighting for abolition. This isn't a unique anomaly to Court Watch NYC, but why do you think this evolution towards abolition happens? And how have you experienced it in your own work?
Yeah, thanks for that question, because I originally didn't write about my own evolution and then sort of added it in the afterword of the book because I felt like it would be incomplete to not also talk about how I have been transformed alongside groups like Court Watch NYC. I was actually in the room when, I guess 7 or 8 years ago now, Court Watch NYC was first formed. It was a coalition. There was Vocal New York. There was the Brooklyn Community Bail Fund. There was Five Borough Defenders. And I was one of the founders of Five Borough Defenders when I was a public defender. And everyone was getting together to court watch. And there was radical energy, don't get me wrong. But the way that the initial trainings for Court Watch NYC talked about it was, we are going to hold prosecutors accountable to their promises. Right. Eric Gonzalez has been elected and he has promised to not prosecute certain drug cases. And we're going to make sure he does that. Right. So there is the sense of accountability of these prosecutors who are calling themselves the people. And it turned out when the court watchers went in, weren't doing exactly what they said. And that's powerful. But that's not abolitionist, at least not in the outward statements of what was happening. If you go forward to the third iteration of Court Watch NYC with the Envision Freedom Fund, with Angel Parker as its leader, it is resolutely abolitionist, right? I was on that first Zoom training. It was saying, we are seeking to dismantle the system. And one of the ways to do that is to understand it, is to take back power, is to tell the public what prosecutors are doing in our name, is to call out the people who are dying on Rikers Island every day, and to connect the seemingly small statements that prosecutors are making on the record that don't seem violent to the violence of jails. And this is the same group and honestly, like the same forms of badass lawyers and radical people and organizers. But what happened is that over time, to be sitting in courtrooms, to be organizing on behalf of people who are being criminalized is, in my view, having talked to groups across the country, inevitably radicalizing. There is something about sitting there and watching that violence again, the violence of a courtroom, right? It seems legal. It seems neutral. But if you watch it over and over again, and then you debrief with court watchers afterward, and then you write reports on it, and then you do it again and again and again, the people might change, but the analysis gets pushed forward and people individually are radicalized. And I see this in every tactic. So I also trace, for example, the Massachusetts Bail Fund, founded in 2011. So it may seem not that long ago, but it's actually a very long time for bail funds today. Switched from a very small legitimizing idea to hashtag free them all, right? We should not have anybody in jails. Participatory defense hubs are increasingly having an abolitionist stance, and certainly people's budgets are as well. And part of the reason it feels so real to me is that that mirrors my own transformation. When I was a public defender, I sat in courts and felt profound injustice every minute. but I did not have the analysis or even the imagination really to say, therefore, there should be other ways to seek justice other than criminal courts. And let's work together to think what that could be. I wasn't there. I wasn't there because I wasn't having those conversations and because my mind wasn't open to it. And I think if I had sat in those, continued to just sit in those courts without being in community with others, it would have taken me longer than what happened, which is I started to work with community bail funds and court watchers, also cop watchers. I started to teach law students and have these open conversations. And being in community with people who are constantly not just criticizing the criminal system and mass incarceration, it's not just critique, it's collectively helping people. It's materially working together in a way that you can say, wait a minute, I think we just did some justice. I think we just kept each other safe. That experience of organizing and materially helping people while engaging in collective analysis is radicalizing in the face of the criminal legal system that we have in the US today.
That's so powerful. You know, just to even conceive is so powerful. And I think it lends itself like a, you know, to a glimmer of hope for those of us that are in this fight and we're wondering why, you know, like we get frustrated and, you know, we say people just don't get it. They don't understand, you know, they're lying about the impact of bail reform. But to see that, you know, this evolution can happen. And sometimes it just, you know, it takes time and it takes meeting people where they're at to really, you know, take shape sometimes.
Yeah. You know, I didn't write this book for organizers. You know, I wrote it for people to learn about the amazing organizing that's happened, for law students, for people who care about the world. But one of the things that's been really exciting is to hear organizers say back to me, wow, it was really powerful to read about the power of the work that I've been doing. Because you can know that it's powerful or feel that it's important, but to have a book that analyzes it in theoretical terms has turned, again, it's not why I wrote the book, but to the extent it can give people a sense of, oh yeah, that was powerful, and just a little bit more energy to keep going. That's kind of a side benefit that I didn't expect.
Along those lines, what do you hope the book will contribute to the public imagination and these conversations about how we keep each other safe?
My hope is that, so again, people who are engaging it can find some energy or momentum to keep going. But my hope is that people will read it and get into the stories that I try to tell about individual organizers and groups of people, and read it and jump into those worlds for a little while for a chapter, and then maybe spark within them a question about whether the criminal system is the only way to seek justice, or police and criminalization are the only way to seek safety. That's sort of an initial, like, sometimes what a great story can do is just make you question something, right? In a way that it might be a week later, it might be a year later, brings you to a moment where you decide, you know, to really ask bigger questions. So that's an initial thing. But what would make me really excited is if people read this and then not just sort of engaged in critique in their head, but looked around their own communities to see what they could get involved in. And I don't mean that everyone should join a community bail fund, although that's great too. I think, you know, since 2020, I'm not just thinking of the uprisings, I'm thinking about the devastation of COVID and all that came with it. There are increasing forms of people taking care of each other and mutual aid all around us. I think a lot of us jumped into mutual aid without calling that or realizing what was happening when we needed to get our elderly neighbors groceries during COVID. Perhaps we weren't doing that before and started doing it more. I think just noticing that there is meaning to helping other people beyond just the love of showing to strangers, but like just taking the next step to analyze that as a form of safety and freedom, and actually political action in addition to individual action, to the extent it helps people think of it that way and lend some inspiration, I would love that.
That's fantastic. So final question, where can people learn more about your work?
Well, they could absolutely buy the book or take it out from their library. It's called Radical Acts of Justice. I'm also trying to, you know, speak to people about the book. So if your organization or group is reading the book and wants to have a conversation with me, whether it's by Zoom or otherwise, I would love to. I do also write legal scholarship. You know, I have lots of law review articles about these things with lots of footnotes that talk about things in more theoretical terms. So it depends on the level that people want to engage. But also, you know, to your listeners, like, I love to engage in public conversation. And so I welcome engagement. You know, tag me on Twitter, email me, read the book, and let me know what you think.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jocelyn.
Thank you for having me. And thanks for all you do.
Of course, of course. And listeners, thank you for joining us again. Peace out.
Thanks again for joining us. Dismantling Injustice is brought to you by Envision Freedom Fund, an organization that works to transform the immigration and criminal legal systems while meeting the critical needs of individuals impacted by these systems daily. To learn more about our work and donate, visit us at envisionfreedom.org. That's envisionfreedom.org. Dismantling Injustice was created by Sally Israel. Our executive producer is Abigail Wolf and hosted by Carl Hammett Lipscomb. That's me. Special thanks to the team at Envision Freedom for being amazing. Until we're all free, peace out.